Extra time is exactly how I find out what's going on in the MLS.
Get lost. Get lost.
Maybe this podcast has influenced me a little bit as well.
Everybody up here, every single day, goes into the office, into the laboratory, to try to cook up some great stuff for you guys.
That's why he's here!
Ah, from New York, New York, you are listening to Extra Time. I am Andrew Wiebe with my partner in soccer, Matt Doyle. Two-man shows continue. God knows where David Goss is, somewhere riding an edge. Doyle, what a life he is living. Got a big show for you today. Latest transfers. It's been a little bit of a quiet week in Major League Soccer. We have a new contract for Facundo Torres, a few little trades going down, and Cade Cowell to the GOATs of Chivas for reportedly $4 million. We'll talk through that one with you, as well as this free agent still on the board. Some big names out there, including Jamiro Montero, Kellen Acosta, Danny Musovski, Junior Moreno, Kai Kamara, and others, and deep dives coming your way on the LA Galaxy and Austin FC. But first, Doyle, the people want to know, particularly Justin Blair, where are the preseason streams? There are a ton of sickos out here hurting. What have you learned about preseason streams? Is that a habit worth having, or should people cut that out of their sicko routine?
I mean, more soccer is better, right? Isn't that what got us to where we are? These That's lofty fair. Positions of prestige and power. We have, between the two of us, watched a lot of preseason streams over the years. I don't know if there are going to be any this year. There weren't last year. But it's a way to spend some time. It is a way to spend some time.
I prefer the preseason in person move.
We're not really into it until we've seen our first alligator outside of Black Bout Stadium in Charleston.
R.I.P.
Black Bout Stadium. What a place that was. That's days of yore, though. It's a different era now.
Or sat atop a tower at the Wide World of Sports in Orlando, watching trialist 1, 2, 3, and 7 do battle with unnamed players by Team X. Preseason is good for one thing. Starting to piece together depth charts, paying attention to signings, getting players up to speed, starting to understand just a little bit, but not all, of what your manager is trying to do when it comes to formation or tactics or player preferences. But we have seen, over the course of this league's lifespan, teams that looked like gangbusters in preseason. Teams that won fill-in-the-blank Arizona Challenge Cup XYZ. It does not translate. The competition, when the regular season starts, is inherently different, and preseason is preseason for a reason. It is preparation. So while I would love to sicko it up with you, I'd love to be watching preseason streams, having my wife ask me, why the hell are you watching this when I'm not going to see you for the next 10 months? I do think we got to pump the brakes on preseason a little bit. The moves are the most important thing. Everything else follows. Let's start with some positivity here. From Reddit, I'm just ducking around. As of now, who is your favorite and your dark horse prediction for the 2024 MLS Wooden Spoon, the most prestigious trophy in Major League Soccer?
I mean, the favorite has to still be Toronto FC. They right now, it feels like they're favorites to go back-to-back, right? Because I don't care what kind of press releases they put out during preseason. It's clear that Insigne, to some degree, and Bernardeschi, with every fiber of his being, do not want to be there. They don't have any center forwards that I really trust. They don't have any central midfielders that I trust other than Jonathan Osorio. Center back is a mess. Fullbacks aren't particularly great. They haven't developed their young players. They took Tyrese Spicer number one in the super draft, and he's a toolsy guy, but it's not clear what position he is. Maybe John Herdman sees him as kind of a Trinidadian Alphonso Davies, and that he's a incredibly athletically gifted left footer who you can turn into an attacking fullback or a wingback. Sean Johnson didn't have a great year last year. He's back. Things don't look good in Toronto. They dug themselves a big old ditch with this roster build, and I think it's going to take more than one window of clearing stuff out to get out of it.
Clearing stuff out is a very kind way of putting it for this Toronto FC team. There are, according to my notes, at least four, if not more, flashing light, sirens blaring, need in the starting 11. They have strikers, Doyle.
Mm-hmm.
The question is, do they have any strikers worth talking about? DeAndre Kerr is the only guy in that attack in front of the midfield that I trust to, one, want to be there, and two, put in his 100% effort every game, and three, overperform expectations.
Yeah.
There is not a single other player in their front three on their depth chart that I would put underneath those three bullets. I mean, the yoke of Insigne and Bernadeschi is so heavy.
Yeah. They're the favorites. Austin doesn't look great right now. I could see them. It could happen with Austin, with them saying, okay, everything that was left over was not good, and we need to do a full reboot before we can be the type of team that Rodolfo Borrell wants them to be. As for dark horses, I mean, it's tough because we're talking about dark horses. We're talking about, like, by its nature, it's something unexpected. If Hani Mukhtar gets hurt, how low could Nashville sink?
I don't think they can sink to the bottom, given the level that back line plays at,
mm-hmm.
and the style of play.
Mm-hmm.
There's an equation that Gary Smith is constantly running in my mind, and that equation is basically, in my mind, lowering the ceiling
to raise the floor.
That floor is so steady.
Yeah,
like they will just get points by sheer will via that back line and style of play and eliminating risks that other teams just won't be able to do. I'm trying to think. Could Montreal would not be a dark horse?
No,
would they?
They would not. Neither would Chicago. Neither would DC. Dallas would be a dark horse.
Dallas would be a dark horse, but they have issues at center back right now. Omar Gonzalez isn't necessarily going to solve those. Maybe if Ferreira was sold mid-season. I just think they have too much talent. Above the playoff line, could Salt Lake be a team that you would throw in there? All the, let's call it, dysfunction that seemed to be going on behind the scenes with Pablo Mastroianni and the coaching staff and disagreements in the front office over direction. It's really Chicho Arango, Diego Luna, and then question marks. Maybe Pablo Ruiz isn't able to come back and be at the level that he was at. The back line showed some gappiness last year.
Mm-hmm. No, it's a good shout. I do like their roster. I think it makes more sense than it did. And I also think that if they sell Savarino, they will then bring in another DP attacker. And I kind of trust them. Maybe I shouldn't, because like it's literally a new chief soccer officer. Kurt Schmidt has taken over as of a month and a half ago. He is the new chief soccer officer, replacing Elliot Fall, who I thought did a pretty decent job going out and spending what ended up being a good amount of money to get guys like Chicho Arango and to bring in guys like Carlos Gomez, who wasn't a starter last year, but he was productive in his MLS minutes. Brian Vera was very good, has played his way into the Colombian national team. I think there's too much talent to see it happening for RSL.
We're stretching for the dark horse.
Which would make them a dark horse, I guess.
For sure. But right now, the one fan base that's looking around, waiting, hoping, praying that their names aren't mentioned, that we should have mentioned probably off the jump, I know they've quote-unquote won the offseason, but the Colorado Rapids got to be in that conversation.
Yeah, I mean, they've earned their way there with the way they've played the past two seasons, but if you look at the shape of this roster now, it makes more sense than I think what they had. But you're right. This is a team that
it's a team with Kevin Cabral and Rafael Navajo as their designated players.
Yeah, no, it's fair. That's a
George
very Mihailovic fair point.
Just came off a poor season, regardless of positional choices by AZ in the Netherlands. Hey, congrats to Cole Bassett. Just got a new contract extension with the Rapids, but they don't really have a six that they trust.
Yep.
TBD on the back line. Zach Steffen is not exactly coming into this situation in peak form. I would believe it.
Yeah.
But certainly Toronto FC are your favorites right now. Let's hit the latest transfers. New contract for a designated player. That's Facundo Torres. 3 years with two option years with Orlando City that takes him through the World Cup in 2026. What does this say to you, Doyle?
I mean, when you have a star DP who has led you to trophies and to, or trophy anyway, and to fantastic season, he was the leading scorer for this team. You reward them. You say, okay, you have earned this level of trust and frankly, this level of money from us. So that's one. And two, I don't think Facundo Torres is going to be in MLS through the end of this contract. I feel like this gives Orlando the ability to go out and negotiate with the teams that are going to be knocking, probably already are knocking on their door, saying, okay, what would it take to get this guy into our team in Europe? Like, could he play for a Sevilla? Absolutely. Team like that? Absolutely. Could we see him at Wolves? Like, yeah, that's the type of team that makes a lot of sense for Facundo Torres. And I expect that if he keeps producing for Orlando City, which I think he will, and if he plays in the Summer's Copa America for Uruguay, which, I mean, he is a regular in that team now, then he will, that type of interest follows on the heels of that. So I think it just puts them in a very good negotiating position. I assume that there is a good relationship between the front office and his representation so that a contract like this is, okay, you are going to have so close to set for life money, and also we're not going to do wrong by you if one of these dream clubs that you have, like if Porto comes knocking on the door, like we're not going to do wrong by you. We're going to make sure that that deal gets done in a way that works for all parties. And just having the leverage to do that and having the long-term security for Facu Torres, it makes sense.
Fabricio Romano, a rumor here, says Pedro de la Vega to Sounders is done. No word, however, from Tommy Scoops. Tom Bogert is silent on this front. So I know I can't believe this fully just yet, Doyle, but Pedro de la Vega seems closer, at least, to the Sounders. We're just waiting for official word.
Yeah, did we talk about this one on Monday? I don't remember.
We didn't, but we've hit it in the past. The needs for the Sounders on the wing, someone to be able to chance create.
Yeah.
Those areas with a little bit more 1v1 ability, somebody who's goal dangerous, and seems like Pedro de la Vega would fit those with those bills.
It does, provided he's healthy, and I know that has been a concern over the past couple of years for him, but the talent is obviously there, and given Seattle's track record hitting on DPs, and I know it's a new regime there with Craig Weibel calling the shots, but I tend to trust Seattle with their scouting and their talent identification and integration.
Trust Tommy Scoops. Trust Instagram reporting. Brandon Vasquez officially to Monterrey. The tweet just came through from FC Cincinnati on quote-unquote a multi-million-dollar transfer. We know that fee to be around the $7.5 million mark with some incentives that could push it another million more to $8.5. Incredible business for Cincinnati, but now all eyes on them. You got the money. You got an open spot in your starting lineup. How do you fill it? Is it Corey Baird? Is it another player? What do you think they'll end up doing?
I still think it's Corey Baird for now, but I expect that they'll get another high-level center forward probably in the summer window. And I'm pulling up the thing. It looks like they have at least one U22 roster slot open. And, of course, they'll open another if they end up selling Alvaro Barrial, though that would then necessitate them getting some sort of replacement for him as well. But Chris Albright he's earned a lot of trust in the very short time that he's been running things in Cincinnati. They haven't missed on a lot of their signings. Now, not all of them have hit immediately, but there seems to be some infrastructure and some institutional know-how in how to get the best out of these guys. As for Brandon Vasquez, did you see what he said in the press? He said he felt like this was the fastest route for him to get to England but to Europe in general. Like he wanted to sign with Monterrey for that reason. And Has anyone let him know what Monterey's transfer policy is?
What?
They do not sell guys to Europe. This is a team that pays as well as anyone outside of Europe.
They bring it the other way.
Yeah. Like, other than maybe Flamengo and Palmeiras, I don't think anyone pays more in the Americas than Monterey have for players. And from what we've heard, you know, Brandon Vasquez is making a lot of money on this deal. It is hard to believe, hard for me to believe that this ends up with him making the jump across the pond. I think this is his, provided he performs at the level that they expect of him, I think this is kind of his forever home. And it's a very good forever home, man. Monterey is still like one of the three biggest teams in North America, given their budget and what they've won over the past dozen years. Like, it's them, it's Tigres, and it's Club America. Like, those are the big three right now in this region. It is a great landing spot. It is not a launching pad to Europe. They have sold, I think, only one significant player. Was it Cesar Montes? They sold to a European team, I think, in 2019. Over the past half decade, that really has been it. So it's strange to see that soundbite coming out of this transfer when Cincinnati have already shown the ability and the willingness to make sales to teams in the top five leagues in Europe.
Brandon Vasquez is 25. I don't see a European move coming, but what I do see for Brandon Vasquez is a pathway to, one, make a ton of money with Monterrey and be in the best possible position to win literally everything. In Mexico, in CONCACAF, they're going to compete at the very upper echelon of any team. The competition's going to be fierce. The quality on the training pitch is going to be amazing. If he wants to go improve and perform at Monterrey, I don't see any reason why he could not, with performances there, push his way into some opportunity with the national team. I don't see why that couldn't happen. If you go perform for Monterrey, why wouldn't that? At that level?
Right.
Why wouldn't you be able to get there? But to go to Europe? Probably not. To make more money in Mexico if Monterrey doesn't work out? Absolutely. To come back to MLS, potentially as a DP in your quote-unquote prime or late prime, whatever it might be, given the contracts, if you perform for Monterrey and win things in CONCACAF in Mexico? Absolutely. To me, it's a no-brainer decision. For Cincinnati, for Brandon Vasquez, if the European offer wasn't there, and clearly it wasn't at the same level financially for Cincinnati, and probably almost certainly not for Brandon Vasquez, given the wages that Monterrey pay, dude, go make yours.
Yeah.
Go get it. This is a career. I feel a lot of times when I'm on Twitter or I'm reading message boards or I'm in the Reddit comment section, there's so many people out there that think about these decisions from a completely different perspective than I think you have to as a professional soccer player. Certainly, you are trying to maximize your ability to play at the very, very highest level, but you're also essentially playing for your life, your livelihood, your present, your future, your family's present and future. There are very real decisions that you got to make. Would Brandon Vasquez like to be at Borussia Mönchengladbach? Sure, sir. Well, yeah, okay, great. Does that mean that Mönchengladbach offered the money to Cincinnati that they would have wanted? Would they have given him this contract? Like, there's some real politics stuff here where it's just like, when Monterrey comes calling, yikes, that's hard to say no to. I don't know how you would. I don't know how anybody listening to this podcast, if their salary was going to be doubled or tripled or whatever it is, and they were going to play at the highest level in the fish pond that they're in, would be like, nah, I think I'll wait around. I think I'll go hopes and dreams for a move that might never materialize. I don't know. That's crazy to me. Monterrey is a huge move. It's a wonderful one for Brandon Vasquez, and I am fascinated to see how he plays. And the market going both ways is clearly opening up. Time to talk Cade Cowell, Doyle. $4 million plus sell-on, says Tommy Scoops. I'm not doubting Tommy Scoops. I just am semi-incredulous that Cade Cowell is sold for $4 million. That seems like a lot more money than I would have expected. But maybe Chivas is over the barrel because they've artificially limited their involvement in the transfer market.
Yeah, for people who don't know, this is Chivas Guadalajara, one of the historical clubs in Liga MX. I think in terms of fan base, they're probably the second biggest club in Liga MX behind Club America, or maybe even neck and neck. They have a policy of only only playing Mexican players. And in the past, they have started to bend this policy. We're talking about 20 years ago. They started recruiting Mexican-American players. Guys who, I mean, there are guys like Brandon Vasquez, guys who were born in the U.S., have Mexican heritage, have dual citizenship, and thus it was decided they pass and can play for Chivas Guadalajara. As part of that, in the past, Chivas has made these guys, I don't know if they signed something, but basically promised they would never play for the U.S. men's national team. They would have to play for El Chiri if they ended up being good enough. And I think Isaac Brizuela, who is also from the Bay Area, he's one of them. There were Miguel Angel Ponce, I believe, was another one. And these are guys who ended up being, I think, fringe Mexican internationals, but played a good long while for Chivas Guadalajara. So when I saw the reports that Cade Cowell was on the verge of being sold to Chivas, I kind of dismissed it because while he is Mexican-American, my understanding is he does not speak Spanish or does not speak it well, for one. And for two, he is cap-tied right now. Now, I think he could make a one-time switch from the U.S. to Mexico, but this is further down the road of being full U.S. international than any player we've seen Chivas recruit before. As Weeby said, they have artificially restricted their pool, but they are still a huge club in terms of their fan base. They're not really a winning club anymore, so they're obviously trying to get creative.
God,
and
drag them.
They're trying to get creative and find talent who could help them compete with the likes of Club America and Monterrey and Tigres. And maybe this is a step toward loosening the restriction and saying, okay, we have to be a mostly Mexican club. We can have two or three non-Mexicans in our roster. But either way, it really caught me by surprise. It is going to be fascinating to see how this plays out for a kid that I think we all agree has a ton of talent, but he has not matched that potential to productivity so far.
Maybe he needed to get outside his bubble.
Yeah.
Different environment, different challenge, different expectations. He is in U.S. national team camp right now. This very moment. There is a possibility that Cade Cowell, as we are talking at 1:41 Eastern time, is on a training field with the U.S. national team.
Wearing red, white, and blue.
On his chest.
Yeah.
It's a fascinating move for a lot of reasons. One, from the MLS side, certainly this relationship with Liga MX, how it's grown, and the opportunity for Cade Cowell. But to your point, maybe more fascinating from the Chivas side and what it means about the present and future of what they're doing. Other moves for Chivas in MLS, Brandon Tellez from the LA Galaxy 2 team, 100K transfer for that one as well, which is a little bit of an outside-the-box interesting move. How do you expect Cade Cowell to do with Chivas?
Yeah, I don't know. They've been a disaster for a while now. They had, a decent run under Matias Almeida half a decade ago. They won their only title, I think, in the past 20 years under him. I think they won a couple other, like Copa MX, and obviously they won the CONCACAF Champions League in 2018. But that's, more than a half a decade ago now. They have been consistently underwhelming, even though they have consistently spent a lot of money. They are bringing Chicharito back, it looks like, which makes a lot of sense for them, given Chicharito, I think, still has some gas left in the tank. But this is not a dominant team. This is not the type of team where Kyle is going to get a ton of the ball and have chance after chance after chance and work through whatever yips he might have developed in front of goal that we saw last year. I don't have the highest expectations. And the other thing to note is Chivas do not sell players. You're looking back through their recent transfer, like you have to go back to, believe it or not, another MLS homegrown, Carlos Salcedo. They sold him for $5 million to Eintracht Frankfurt back in 2019. That is the last significant sale to of a any Chivas player to a European club. So it's an interesting move in a lot of ways. I hope for Cade Cowell's sake that it ends up being the right move. I would be a little bit surprised if it was.
Big club, big pressure. Roberto Alvarado playing left wing for them much of last year. Our producer Maria would be furious if I did not mention that Pumas knocked out Chivas Guadalajara in the last Liguilla. So congratulations, vamos equipo, Maria, for Pumas. We're also doing some business, and all this is important too because it's not just Liga MX we're going to watch these guys. Whether it's Chicharito or Cade Cowell or, you know, fill in the blank here. Brandon Vasquez, it's Leagues Cup.
Yeah.
It's CONCACAF Champions Cup. The ties between the two leagues and the head-to-head matchups and true competitive games are just going to get more frequent, and I am fascinated to see Cade Cowell come back and play MLS opposition and see where his place in the team is. I'm more fascinated, honestly, to see how Chicharito fares in a return to Guadalajara. I mean, that is going to be all anyone talks about in Mexico.
We'll see. I think that people are going to end up talking about Cade Cowell quite a bit just because of what it might signal for Chivas and how they run their club. And look, man, like, there's a part of what Chivas do that I think is admirable because part of it is about creating Mexican national team players and trying to make Mexico one of the truly great world powers in international soccer. And I like that they take that on themselves. But it doesn't work to run a soccer club in, like, we're almost 30 years post-Bosman ruling. It does not work to run a soccer club like that, and you limit yourself. You end up paying more for players who other teams could have for less. You limit the pool of talent, and you don't win. And that's been the story of the past 15, 20 years for Chivas Guadalajara. And if Cade Cowell signals the end of that, it's probably a good thing for that team as a whole.
What an interesting place for Cade Cowell to potentially have in the history of one of the biggest clubs in not just this region, but, and people might laugh, the world. Rapids, RSL, doing business. Rapids traded an international spot in the 2025 second rounder, maybe up to 100K in GAM for RSL's Jasper Lofelson. Got anything there? Anything for me?
I mean, I like Jasper Lofelsund. I thought he was good in 2022. I thought he was really good. He kind of struggled last year, but RSL were weird last year, as we kind of talked about near the top. Seems like a good low-cost backup number six and backup right back. So that
is he a six in your mind or is he an eight?
So I think if you play him next to Connor Ronan, Connor Ronan is better when he's deeper. And he's kind of Jack Pricey like that, but he needs a bodyguard. He does not win the ball at all. So you need someone with a high motor and who can win the ball all over the field next to him. And that's how Lofelson played in central midfield. Now, is that an eight or is that a six? Which one's the eight? Which one's the six? To me, Ronan's playing deeper and kind of organizing the game. That's maybe more of a six. Whether, I mean, the better way to think about it, I think, is like one's the ball winner and one's the conductor. And so if Lofelson is playing next to Ronan, Ronan's the conductor, Lofelson's the ball winner. It looks like a good fit to me. And then having Cole Bassett in front of him, Cole Bassett being a number 10, but really kind of an 8.5, because, you know, the advantage he gives you at that spot is his energy and his ball winning. You have, I think, enough in the central midfield to kind of hide kind of Ronan defensively. And then at right back, it's plug and play behind Keegan Rosenberry. Like, it was a spot where they needed a little bit of depth, and they got it at two spots. It's good work from Colorado. And from RSL, they have depth at both those spots already because they do such good work pushing guys to their academy, and they do such good work in the draft. They got Emeka Anelli last year to play right back. They drafted Kevin Benia, who's a right back this year in the first round, who was a consensus best right back in the draft. That gives them the flexibility to turn a third round draft pick 2 years later into $100,000 worth of GAM and an international roster slot. So I think well done to both front offices.
On the flip side for Colorado, if you're sort of digging through their depth chart in their 11, as I saw Marcelo Balboa doing this morning, his argument was that Cole Bassett is more of the 8, maybe next to Connor Ronan, and Georgi Mihailovic is the 10. I could see that, but I also think Georgi at left wing is going to play like a 10.
Yeah.
He's going to tuck inside. He's going to try to receive the ball in the half spaces. It puts him in a better position to play crosses and have two guys running in dangerous positions, in whether it's Navajo or Yapi, and then Cole Bassett. But it's interesting to see and to think about how Chris Armas might deploy those guys.
I would be surprised if it's not Bassett as the nominal number 10, though an inverted Mihailovic on the left wing is the primary chance creator.
Yes.
And I would be surprised if that's not how they at least came out and started this season. It might evolve over time. Things tend to. But that's where both players have looked their best over the course of their career. So why would you try something different from the start?
Nice thing, too, in free agency, Omer Fernandez, he could play that 10 role.
Mm-hmm.
Or almost like a second forward behind the striker. And he could play left wing, too. One big thing I'm watching for the Rapids, and we'll move on, the development of Ralph Preso with Chris Armas. Ralph Preso had a ton of talent and had a big sort of transfer number put on him within MLS terms in the make weight in the Mark Anthony Kay deal. Ralph Preso has not lived up to that promise in Colorado. I'm curious to see if one of the best defensive midfielders of all time in this league, in Chris Armas, can find something within Ralph Preso to help push his career forward, because it really seems like it's stalled out for the time being. Speaking of number sixes who've done everything in this league, Dax McCarty to Atlanta is official. Julian Gressel to Miami is official. Vancouver Whitecaps close to a deal with Fafa Picot on a 1+1. That's 1 year guaranteed, one option year. It won't be a TAM contract for the former Nashville winger. So free agents still on the board, Doyle. Kai Wagner, still waiting. Not much out of the Philadelphia Union camp that we're hearing. Nothing really official going down for them. I know Union fans, at least in my mentions, are quite frustrated about that. Alejandro Bedoya is in that same boat. Carlos Vela, I see he is on vacation, thanks to the Graham, which he deserves. We'll see what happens with him in LAFC and also with Denny Bawanga. That certainly doesn't look like has a resolution coming anytime soon. How about Jamiro Montero? Where could you send Jamiro Montero? Can I throw in a suggestion at you?
Do it.
Let's say Coco Carrasquilla gets sold. Houston seems to have been flirting with that scenario for multiple windows now. Carrasquilla seems like he'd like to do that as well. I know they got Kowalczyk to be a make weight to sort of back it up just in case. But what if you went and got Jamiro Montero? Not really a traditional 10, but could he play an 8 next to Hector Herrera? Certainly. Certainly could. Could he play that, Bossy position if Bossy was injured? I think he could do that as well. And if Hector Herrera needs a blow or is injured or whatever, you've got a high-level replacement there as well, and it allows you to sell Coco Carrasquilla, assuming there is concrete interest in Carrasquilla at the numbers that you want.
I like it. I think it's the just looking over the depth charts and the rosters for teams around the league, it's the best fit because and by the end of the year, Ben Olsen had this team playing a 4-2-3-1, and it was Aceh deep next to Artur, and Artur would hold, Aceh would go. Bassey was a 10, but it didn't end up being a 4-2-3-1 in attack because Coco Carrasquilla was playing as a right winger who would tuck in and create overloads in the middle and clear out a runway for Griffin Dorsey on the overlap. It was unique. No other team in MLS played a 4-2-3-1 like this. And as you said, I think Jamiro Montero could fit in four of those spots. Specifically, I like the idea of him as a direct replacement for Coco because Montero's not really a 10, but he always wants to be on the ball inside. And that is what that right, quote, wing role was for the Dynamo down the stretch in 2023. And they played it so well. So it makes a lot of sense to me. He does give you a backup to Bossy. He does give you a backup to Ace as well. The question with Jamiro Montero is buy-in. Like, will that be enough for him? Because what we've seen in the past is he wants to be a number 10. He wants to be the man. And he's good, but he's not elite at that. And if you're a team that wants to win trophies, and the Dynamo do, and they did last year, then I think you need a better player as your primary chance creator. Is he willing to accept that at this point in his career? I mean, he's 30 now. You know, this is going to be his last decent contract, I think. And he got the chance to run the show the past few years, and it didn't go great in San Jose. So hopefully he will, and hopefully he finds the right spot. And just based upon everything you laid out, Houston feels like a good landing spot, man.
Koko Kariski is probably the domino that's got to shift there based on the salary. I would throw Dallas out there as well, another team that plays with sort of dual eights. Can he compete with Legette and Pomichael? Certainly. I think there's a good chance he would win one of those spots. TBD on their contract situation. Center back is a more pressing need for FC Dallas at this point either. Either way, Charlotte are looking for a 10, but it looks like they have a completely different profile in mind, as they should, given the money that they have spent and the expectations with Dean Smith, as we chronicled in our last show. Still no word on Grønbæk, their target out of the northern reaches of Norway. DC United is another one I would potentially throw out there as well. I know they just triggered the permanent transfer on Gabriel Pirani, but that's a young player, and you're putting a lot on him. And when you have Christian Benteke, I would think you would want some more established guys to try to just make the playoffs under Troy Lesane. And Jamiro Montero would seem to fit that sort of transition game.
Well, I'll tell you, in D.C. last year, they were at their best when they were playing a 4-4-2 diamond with DiPietro, Kudipietro, and Benteke up top. Mm-hmm. And then you have Click as 1-8. You don't have another 8 now. And Montero, I think his best moments in MLS came when he was playing as a number 8 for the Union for a year. I want to say 2019, or maybe it was 2020. He was better at that spot than he was as a 10. So if that's what Troy Lesane is looking for, and he has tended to prefer two forward formations in the past, that's also a very good fit for Montero. But again, buy-in is the thing. Is he willing to play as a shuttler now, or does he see himself solely as a number 10?
Have you locked in on the fire for Kellen Acosta?
It's what I'm expecting, but it's not done. And if it's not done, then this is MLS, man. Anything can happen.
Any other teams that would be able to usurp that, you think?
You're the one who's coming up with all the good suggestions, right?
I'm letting fly right now.
Right?
In a dream world, I don't think the cap space exists there, but Atlanta United would have been a dream world. Think about that Atlanta United midfield with Kellen and Muyumba and Almada.
That's real good. That's real good.
I don't know if we're in that world necessarily, but it's a fun one. Now, look, Kellen made 1.3 last year, according to the Players Union. So that's a stumbling block. Most good teams in MLS are already going to have, just based on the signings they made to get to that point and their use of high-end spots on the roster, whether it be DPs or TAM, are probably going to have a difficult time fitting that number in, if it's anywhere around that number, which you would expect it to be. Why would Kellen be asking for less? That's going to be tough for established teams, and that's why you go look at a team like the Fire. And for Kellen, I think that does make sense, as we detailed positionally. But I think also, and this matters to go back to the Brandon Vasquez thing, from a lifestyle perspective. Like, L.A. to Chicago, exploring a different style of life, a different place, a big city. He seems like that sort of guy. The opportunity to play the position that you want to play. A club that needs someone like him to change the culture and elevate it. We'll see. It could work out.
How about Cincinnati?
Yeah.
Right? Because Cincinnati, they obviously have a lot of GAM now.
Brandon Vasquez money?
Right.
Vasquez was right around that number, I think, like 1.1, 1.2.
And Junior Moreno, who I think was much better over the last 2 years for Cincinnati than I thought he was going to be. But he is still a free agent They have not re-signed him. Obviously, Kellen would hit the cap at a much higher number than Junior Moreno hit the past couple of years, but he also represents, I think, an upgrade. That would be a pretty good fit.
I like the fit. Nashville, before they signed Drew Yearwood. Again, it's a money issue, and all this comes back to that. We're out here just throwing darts at a board. This is the easy part, right?
Yeah.
Actually constructing the salary cap in a way that you can sign players of that level, that's the hard part. Any suggestions, hit us up. Danny Mussofsky thought he would be off the board, Doyle. What happened? Where's he going?
Yeah, I don't know. He was really good for most of last year with RSL. He was, I think, their leading scorer across all competitions. Historically, in his, I want to say, about 5,000 minutes across all competitions with LAFC and RSL, he scores a goal about every 200 minutes. And the underlying numbers have tended to be pretty good as well. Whenever he has dropped down to USL, he's scored for fun there. So he's clearly a guy who knows where the goal is, and it has translated in MLS. He doesn't do much else. He's not a playmaking forward. He's not dominant in the air. He can link play a little bit, but he's not going to unlock the final ball. It feels like there are a lot of teams who could use a guy like that, especially because he's in his prime. One is Vancouver. They just sold Simon Betcher. I know they signed Demir Krylock. They have Levante Johnson. You can't really count on Krylock to be healthy much this year.
Is that breaking up the white Gauld?
No. At this point,
up top, or you're saying Gauld is a 10?
Gauld is a second forward, and White is the starter, and Mussofsky is the backup. Because Vancouver's, they're playing in CC, you know, CONCACAF Champions Cup. They're going to be playing, you know, trying to win the Supporters Shield, trying to win Canadian Championship.
Make that CCL.
Yeah,
mistake.
It's going to happen a lot. So Vancouver as a backup, Houston,
how about Seattle.
Seattle as a backup makes a lot of sense. Yeah.
Yeah. Because, I mean, it seems like this is Rui Diaz's last year. Say you sign him on a Mussofsky on a 2+1 or whatever it is.
Mm-hmm.
Now you can push Morris to the left wing. You give De La Vega more time to adapt. If it's not working out, Morris can be your starter up top. Then you give more space for Rui Diaz. Ultimately, it is a depth piece. But if you're the Sounders, you generally expect to be playing in a ton of competitions as well. And if you're Mussofsky, it seems like you'd probably like to go to a winner at this point in your career.
Yeah. I think that one fits really well. NYCFC could use another forward. I like what I saw from Munsaf Bakrar down the stretch last year. I'm not sure he's a 15-goal guy. Now, Mussofsky might not be either, but if you prorate his numbers in MLS over the past 4 or 5 years, he has produced on a per-minute basis like a 15-goal scorer. NYCFC would work because they keep the ball on the ground, and I think that's where Mussofsky's at his best. I don't know if he's their type of signing, but there's gonna end up being a couple teams in for this guy. I would be surprised if there wasn't.
How about the Galaxy? Speaking of teams that keep the ball on the floor, Jovalich up top, Miguel Berry signed in the offseason, Danny Mussofsky makes that group three. You can go use that left wing spot on a designated player. Mm-hmm. Then you have Gabriel Peck, which we'll get to in a second because we're going to deep dive the Galaxy. Whoever it is, maybe it's Diego Fagundes, maybe it's another DP on the left, Ricky Puig underneath, and Danny Mussofsky just tooling around the box trying to find ways to put the ball in the back of the net.
Yeah, I like that. You know, I kind of went into this offseason with the assumption that the Galaxy would sign two DPs, one being a winger and one being a center forward to replace Chicharito. But I've now heard some whispers over the past couple of days that, yeah, they're going to get Gabriel Peck on one side, but Gabriel Peck's more of a Diego Rossi type of winger. Diego Rossi during his LAFC days, where he was the one who was finishing plays off, not necessarily playmaking winger. And then they're going to still look for a playmaking inverted winger on the left side, and Diego Fagundes would then end up being sort of the depth piece, which is very good depth to have in MLS. And the idea behind it is if you have that much playmaking and that much danger from your number 10, and we both rate Ricky Puig, we think he's one of the best players in the league,
mm-hmm.
and you have it from two DP wingers who are in their prime, then you don't need a super elite number nine. You need guys who know the job and understand where the goal is and can do the job. And if their number nine core is Dejan Jovalić, who would probably be considered the starter, and Danny Musovski and Miguel Barry, then you're kind of set. So yeah, the Galaxy do make a lot of sense. Weeby, what that said, if you're the Galaxy, do you use that open, let's assume they signed Gabriel Peck, would you use that open DP slot on another winger or the number nine?
Oh, let's answer this question by deep diving the LA Galaxy. So Gabriel Peck looks like it's, I'm not going to say done, but trending heavily in that direction from Vasco da Gama in Brazil. 22-year-old, as you said, left-footed, inverted winger coming from the right side. A goal scorer, but also an assist man, but, you know, in that Diego Rossi mold. There are some moves they've made here, mostly on the depth side. Miguel Barry, backup forward. John Nelson, a backup left back behind Aude. Miki Yamane out of Japan, a 30-year-old Japanese international. He is the starter at right back. Remember, Caligari was sent back because he had the big injury and they did not trigger that purchase option. Big time outs. Chicharito, Douglas Costa, two DP spots open. Uri Russell out. Billy Sharp out, sadly. Caligari out. Michael Barrios out. Kelvin Leerdam and others who didn't really get much of a much time on the field for Greg Vanney. Three trades. Raheem Edwards out. $400K into the coffers from Montreal. Preston Judd to San Jose. $200K in GAM into the coffers. $100K in 24 and 25. And then Tyler Boyd sent to Nashville for some international roster spots in each of 24 and 25. And $150K in GAM that could rise all the way up to $775. So good business so far by Will Koontz. But Will Koontz is going to be judged on these DP signings, Doyle. There's no doubt about it. How does the Galaxy 11 right now, and let's include Gabriel Peck just for the sake of, you know, imagining what this could look like in this group. What's the 11 in your mind?
It looks really good. I was actually surprised by that. Still a question mark at striker, but Dejan Jovalić, I think, is a starting caliber, about average MLS number 9. Fagundes and Peck on the wings. Ricky Pudge as a number 10. Mark Delgado and Gaston Brugman, who we expect to be healthy again, in deep midfield. Brugman kind of as the conductor and Delgado as the runner. Then Aude, who was good last year as a left back. Jalen Neal as a left center back. Maya Yoshida as the right center back. And his countryman, Miki Yamane, as the right back. And then a big question mark in goal. They have right now Jonathan Bond, who has frankly not been very good the past few years. John McCarthy, who I'm not sure is an MLS starter. And a Serbian, Nemanja Miković, who played a couple of games in MLS Next Pro and a couple of games for the Galaxy last year. So still a question mark at goal. But they have guys who are average or above, I want to say, seven positions. And then a couple guys who are potentially excellent, like best 11 caliber, if Will Koontz hits on these DP signings.
Ricky Pudge and who?
Ricky Pudge, Miki Yamane. He has a really big reputation in Japan, really well-regarded, talented player.
I believe J-League best 11 himself three times.
There you go. And Gabriel Peck, given his underlying numbers and what he did in the Brazilian Serie A, which is a very good league. It is not wild to think that he could walk. I'm not going to assume he does it, but to think that he could walk in here and put up a Diego Rossi type of season, it's not out of place.
Brugman's a big one for me.
Yeah, he has to be healthy.
Ball progression out of that midfield into Puja's feet in places where he can turn and go and be the magical player that we know he can be. When Brugman went down last year, it was a huge, huge price to pay, and that gives Mark Delgado more of a clear role in front of the center back pairing that has been shaky for a long time, but is sort of remade in Jalen Neal getting the opportunity next to Yoshida. I do like there's depth there on the back line, Mavinga and Caceres. Now look, don't know how much quality there is. Certainly keep Martin away from the VAR booth, but you have two veterans who can push in there, and then Zavaleta as well in that mold. Let's get back to that DP question. I would go wing. Fagundes now gives you depth at the wing spot as well as the 10 spot.
Mm-hmm.
Can be a starter, probably not a top-level best 11 starter, but can be very productive in the right system. And I think Greg Vanney's system could be that. Put the ball at his feet, give him opportunities to play. He can be very good in that situation. And I also just think it's cap math. You have Jovalich on a U22 deal still, yep. I believe. So going and spending a DP spot and a U22, given that Jovalich has had multiple years and shown the ability to score, it's a little bit shaky for me. So I think the biggest impact you can make is players who will be around Ricky Pujmore. To your point, I would go look at that left wing. Right now, the rumor is Facundo Pellistri out of Manchester United. That seems like a big O swing. Not sure that's going to happen for them, but maybe the Ricky Puig example can be one they use to sell on other guys.
Right? It's literally the Ricky Puig model, where it's a guy who clearly has the talent to play at a big club, but has not quite fit in his current place in Manchester United. Okay, let's go out on loan and see if he can do it in MLS. Or maybe even it's an outright move. And they have the ability to do that and still have access to all three U22 slots, because either Pellistri or Gabriel Peck would count as a young DP.
This is what's been missing for the Galaxy, by the way. Just some of that simple math right there.
Yeah.
On how to maximize roster spots.
And budget. Young DP, like Pellistri and Peck combined, I believe would hit the salary cap at $400,000 combined. Then you add in Jovalich, who's a U22. That's another, I think, $250,000. So that allows you to go out and get guys like a Japanese international, three-time best 11 right back to fill what has been a gap for a long, long time. It's the basic stuff. It is the smart roster building that we saw out of LAFC when Will Kuntz was there, and that we have not seen out of the Galaxy for a good long while.
Where did the Galaxy aim this year? Greg Vanney aimed high last year.
Yeah.
I wouldn't come out the gate saying anything about a shield or any trophies if I was the LA Galaxy. I would try to tamp down some expectations. What do you expect?
I expect them to be an open, high-scoring, mid to upper 50s point team that does not defend well enough to seriously threaten to win anything. And the reason I don't expect them to defend well enough is just we have a pretty solid sample size now that Vanny's teams just struggle with rest defense. It's like the opposite of what the Sounders were last year. The Sounders were a ball dominant possession team, but they played small in order to make sure that they were always in position to repress anytime they lost the ball. Whereas if you look at the Galaxy, whenever they lose the ball, guys are 30 yards away. And that allows teams to pick their passes and start building. And they're even when they're defending 80 yards up the field, they're always chasing. And I think teams are just too good and too smart. There's too much tape. There's too much understanding of how to attack disorganized teams now for that to work in the highest pressure game. Maybe that's wrong. Maybe there will be significant improvement from the Galaxy year over year. I'm not expecting it, but I am expecting more goals and more fun than what we saw in 2023.
Return of Brugman will help as well. And just the minutes that Jalen Neal has under his belt. We talked about Ralph Priso under Chris Armas. Jalen Neal is a guy who could make, quote unquote, the leap this year. He showed a lot of signs. It's a hard position to play at a young age. Having Yoshida next to him should help. Having Yamane should help as well, but there is a big question at goalkeeper. So who has the better season in 24 in Los Angeles? The Galaxy or LAFC, who are suddenly in a little bit of turmoil?
I'm gonna put it on you. Which roster would you rather have right now?
Oh, I think I would rather have the Galaxy's roster right now.
Walk me through that.
I would definitely rather have the back line of LAFC.
Mm-hmm.
But there are some serious holes in the front six for LA and some massive question marks. Bogush, Oliveira, Buyuk, Krastev. Don't know what you're going to get out of any of those guys. I have no idea. Ilya, Can he hold off Father Time? They don't have a nine. Apologies to Mario Gonzalez. Denny Bawanga certainly seems like he is not interested in sticking around. They've got to offer him a much improved deal, and you still got to wonder if he says you should have done that 6 months ago, 3 months ago, 2 weeks ago, whatever it is. If they have Denny Bawanga, I'll take LAFC. If Denny Bawanga is disgruntled and still wants to leave or has left, I'll take the Galaxy.
What is your confidence level?
My shrine, by the way, is in full bonfire mode. Just absolute bonfire mode. God. This is a absolute fringe take. This could be, I could really regret this.
I got to tell you, that monologue from you right there was the Galaxy's biggest win in 9 years. So congratulations to them. What is your confidence level in LAFC figuring this out and getting it squared away before this? And it needs to be said, they do not have CONCACAF Champions Cup on their plate. So they're not scrambling to get this done in the next 4 weeks. It's the next six.
It's more of a political thing with Bawanga than it is anything else, right? He's under contract. So strictly from a contractual position, they got this under control. But we know, everyone knows, everyone understands that that's not, you know, just because you got somebody on under contract doesn't mean they want to be there, doesn't mean they're happy, doesn't mean they're going to perform at the level that the LAFC need him to perform at. Because they have two open DP spots and they have a boatload of talented young players that haven't shown that they are impact players in MLS yet. And I'm not putting Oliveira into that category. Mm-hmm. He has impacted games. Is he a consistently impactful player? I don't know. Now, we don't know if Gabriel Peck is in MLS yet either. Certainly seems like he will be, but that's a TBD as well. I am surprised. I'm surprised about the way LAFC has seen two critical assets leave for basically nothing. The two young Ecuadorians they signed. The most recent, of course, being Chiqui Palacios. That's surprising to me that they didn't figure out a way to use those assets to refill the tank, so to speak. It's surprising to me that they sat around last year with a DP spot open after all the money they spent and the players they attracted to win MLS Cup. It's surprising to me that they have two DP spots open and we haven't heard a single rumor about how they might fill those. LAFC are supposed to be a giant. Their performances, their results, their history as a club, the way they talk about themselves and portray themselves would be as a giant. And I'm not seeing a ton of giant behavior this offseason. Is that harsh?
No, it's reasonable given the way things stand right now, but things can and do change very quickly
and
in this league.
Yeah, it should change. I just went on this rant, and probably John Thorington's like, "Don't worry about me, bro.
Yeah,
I got this."
I'm sure he's listening.
I'm not putting my business in the streets.
Your take then is that the Galaxy will have a better 2024 than LAFC.
If the Galaxy are upper 50s points, to your point, you're acting like I'm crazy and you just predicted they'd be in the mid to upper 50s. If they're in that position, that's like top four.
Mm-hmm.
Solidly top four in either conference.
Okay. And you don't think that LAFC are going to be a top four team in the Western Conference?
I do. But they were a top four team last year with Bawanga having a season that's probably impossible to replicate, with a TBD on Carlos Vela even being involved, with Giorgio Chiellini gone, with a best 11 quality outside back gone, and relying on a ton of young players to elevate them from a season when they had 52 points. Now, I know last season was nutty. They played a crap ton of games. They got the finals. They had emotional gut punches out the wazoo. I think it's going to be neck and neck, and that's what both clubs need. That's what MLS needs, and that's fascinating. All right, let's get to Austin. Ben Wright wrote, who is the most work still to do to have a semi-functional roster? Austin, Minnesota, or Toronto? Minnesota just got caught astray right there. Minnesota, Ben. Minnesota are eons above Austin and Toronto. We obviously put Toronto in the spoon favorite category. So let's dig in on Austin. RB22 says, talk about the ambition Austin is showing this window. Wait, what ambition? And their potential ceiling with all the moves that they're making. Vanilla Mexican 17, where do you see Austin FC in 2024? In my opinion, this club isn't ready for the 2024 season. Couple moves here of late. Guilherme Biro, a 23-year-old left back from Brazil, has played in the top division and the second division, most recently in the second division, was signed. Johan Romano was sold to San Lorenzo, which, whew, Rodolfo Borrell, that's incredible business to get anything for Romano at this point. Jader Obreon was taken in the reentry draft and stage one, which means they, I believe it means that they activated his option, whatever the option number was, but I'm not entirely sure there. There are rumors about him going to Mexico right now. Stephen Cleveland signed in free agency, and Micah Burton, a 17-year-old U.S. Youth International forward, was just signed this week. Out, Kip Keller, Adam Lundqvist, Rodney Redes, Memo Rodriguez, Maxi Arruti, Nick Lima, and Romana, as mentioned. Doyle, take us through the 11, how you see it now, and where the big holes are.
I mean, their strength is Brad Stuver in goal, and then they have talent in the midfield with Driussi, Owen Wolf, and Danny Pereira. The questions there are, one, can Driussi conduct a game? Because he's not really an orchestrator of a number 10. He's more of a box finisher type of guy. And we saw last year when things start to fall apart for Austin, he wasn't able to influence the game. And you contrast that to some, well, we mentioned Minnesota, so contrast it to Emmanuel Reynoso. When things start falling apart for Minnesota, he goes into midfield and he finds and he makes the game. Driussi's not that type of number 10. So he needs the guys behind him to do that work. Owen Wolf was really good and really promising for an 18-year-old, right? He was not an elite MLS player by any stretch last year, but I think he can be in a couple years. Danny Pereira, I think, is really good, but he's not really a ball winner. And playing next to Owen Wolf, you need a ball winner. So it just didn't fit through the middle. And that was the strongest part of the team. Their center backs, look, Matt Hedges has had a great career, but he is, at this point, not super mobile and frequently injured. Julio Cascante has only ever been a borderline starter in this league. Leo Viisanen was injured and did not look great last year. They don't have a starting caliber right back right now. Hector Jimenez is still around, and he's a great locker room guy, but you're not going to ask him to play 3,000 minutes. John Gallagher was a silver lining last year. He's the starting left back. He is probably one of the strengths of the team. And then the wingers are Jader Obreon, who was, you know, his option was not picked up by Dallas for a reason. And then Emiliano Rigoni, who is one of the most disappointing DPs in recent history. And then Jossie Zardes is the center forward. Like, that's not, none of that is great. I'm not sure any of those three guys are starters for a playoff caliber team at this point. The real rub here is that, you know, when we're talking about the Galaxy being remade, we're talking about multiple DP slots open. We're talking about Austin. Rigoni's a DP. Driussi's a DP. Alex Ring is a DP. Now, I'm pretty sure they could buy Alex Ring down. They could open up that slot with Tam. They could slot him back as the number six. And then that adjustment opens up flexibility to do other stuff. Rigoni, though, I think they have to buy the bullet or bite the bullet and buy him out. And if they don't do that, then the whole system doesn't work, because the system is designed to put the wingers into 1v1s against isolated defenders, and then to turn those 1v1s into cutbacks across the box for one-time finishes from their forward and from Driussi. The problem with Rigoni is he just can't create separation, so he can't beat anybody 1v1. He just was not able to do it. They were more effective with Ethan Finley, who's a really, you know, good long-serving player in this league, but he's not a wizard or anything. He just gets to the end line and hits pullbacks from the end line. It's a lot to piece together. It is, I think, outside of Toronto, the biggest rebuilding job in the league. And the difference is, you know, Toronto probably has an easy out with both of their DPs if they can, like, because Insigne and Bernardeschi still have value, I think, in the international market. I'm not sure Austin has that.
Had a ton of people hitting us up to hear about where Austin are headed. Rodolfo Borrell, to me, shouldn't be in a hurry. And I think a little bit about what Pat Onstad did down the road in Houston, where he arrived in this job and had some, let's say, had some shackles that he didn't choose. Decisions of the past that he just couldn't change when it came to contracts. And I understand the instinct to say, hey, just go buy out Rigoni. Just go do it. Just go just spend that money. But if you are Rodolfo Borrell and you understand that resources are limited, that's a reality for any club in the world outside of maybe one or two. You might just have to eat Rigoni for now. You might have to ask Josh Wolf to get the best out of him. Because one, if you go spend the money on buying out Rigoni, that's money you might not be able to spend on your first team roster in general, whether it be via transfer fees or otherwise. And two, you might not be ready to do that. Your target might not be there. Is now the time to go do it? The only reason you buy out Rigoni, in my opinion, is if you've got somebody lined up right now. Otherwise, why? Why spend the money? Why create the hole in the roster? Wait till the summer. Maybe Rigoni plays himself into a transfer back to Argentina or Brazil. Probably not going to make any money on that, but maybe you can move him off the roster without having to buy him out. The Obreon one is interesting. They need another player who can stretch the field. They need anybody who can stretch the field and be goal dangerous. If he doesn't stick around, and I know it's just a rumor at this point, that's a big flag for this team as well. I just think if I was Rodolfo Borrell, I would be patient. I would know that I don't gotta boil the ocean in the first window. I don't have to do it in the first year either. I was hired to have a long-term project. And part of that project is evaluating players, but it's also evaluating Josh Wolf and how he's able to turn around a team that was at an epic high point in year two and then sort of hit the valley in year three. So it's a big test. It's a big test for Austin. What are the right expectations? Because Borrell said off the jump that the expectations from year two to year three were wrong. So what would the right expectations be? How should we measure these guys?
I don't even know. Honestly, the roster is so incomplete and the pieces that are remaining are so ill-fitting that I am struggling to create a frame of reference from which I can adequately assess this team. What I will say is I'm not certain Danny Pereira is going to be a part of it by the time the regular season starts. Whispers around the league, he's not exactly being shopped, but he's not exactly... Look.
He's not being shopped.
And I understand, like, I love Danny Pereira. If I was, you know, any number of teams in this league, I would be looking to add him to my midfield as a starter. I think he's very, very good. He's probably not the right fit next to Owen Wolf. We probably need more of a pure ball winner next to Owen Wolf, and a good way to generate an international roster slot and a lot of allocation money would be to sell someone within the league, sell Danny Pereira within the league. I'm not sure it's going to happen, but I'm not ruling it out. Once moves like that are done, then I will have a better feel for what to expect from Austin this year. What I will say is I will be disappointed if at the end of 2024 they're not more dimensional in the attack than they were in 2023. They had the highest total cross ratio in the league last year, and total cross ratio is simple. It's the number of passes played into the box that are crosses. Ideally, you want to be down 30-35%. Austin last year were at like 48%, which is the highest number in MLS since Chivas USA back in 2014. And it's just like they had no ideas in the attack. And the number one thing I want to see in 2024, forget points, forget trophies, even forget player development, is just show me you have ideas. That is, I think, a useful measuring stick for this team.
Mid-40s points-wise.
Under.
That's fair. All right. Austin fans, let us know what you think. Let's hit the mailbag and get on out of here. Bird Doge like the coin. What are teams one player away from a trophy push? Name the team, name the player type, perfect fit player. Let's just throw some out there, Doyle. How about Red Bulls, a number nine? Dante Van Zier is the second forward. Emil Forsberg is a Bundesliga above average player, let's just say. Lewis Morgan is back from being broken. Young, talented midfielders, a back line, and goalkeeper that put up a great defensive season last year. Goal scoring, number nine.
Yeah, my initial reaction was, no, they need so much more than that. But I think my initial reaction might be wrong. Because this is a team that controlled most of the games they played in last year. Daniel Edelman and Frankie Amaya both took big steps and were really good in central midfield. They don't have a ton of depth behind them now. Peter Stroud, I think, is next on the depth chart. So they could be thin. But if they get a goal-scoring nine, someone who turns all that dominance, that positional dominance they showed last year, turns that into goals, then yeah, this is a team that could win something for sure.
Give me a team. Who you got?
Atlanta.
I just got Matt Doyle to say the Red Bulls are a team that could, quote, win something. It's a huge victory for me.
Atlanta. If Atlanta are able to go out and get a number six who is as good at that position as Muyumba was as a sort of a box-to-box, do-everything ball winner in central midfield, then with that attack, that, you know, sure, they'll give up 50 goals still, but I think that would be enough for them to be a team that is a legitimate championship contender in one competition or another.
Six or center back for Atlanta?
I would go for the six. Because I think Dax partially answers the question, but he's not a long-term answer, and I don't think it would be reasonable to expect him to be as good and as fresh as in November and December as I expect him to be in February, March, April.
Fair enough. I'll throw out the let's go Sporting Kansas City. If you're saying I'm a Galaxy homer, by God, I've got to stick with my Charlie Davies inspired Sporting Kansas City homerism. Gadi Kinda replacement, open DP spot.
Yep.
Shallowy, Russell, Polito under long-term contract, Eric Tommy in and around here. There is a question about how you would use that spot with Eric Tommy. Depends on how you rate him. Voltaire, Radoja. The question is, would you do this or would you do a 10 or a center back? Again, that comes down to Tommy, but pick one or the other. I think this team has all the attributes to be a trophy contender, and they seem to be on a cycle. Good year, not so good year. Good year, not so good year. We might be back at the good year cycle.
Yeah, I think DP number 10 is probably the right answer, but if you could get into a time machine and go kidnap prime Matt Beisler or prime Ike Opara, bring him to 2024, I think that would help this team quite a bit as well.
Advocating for kidnapping on this show. I think,
time traveling and kidnapping.
New England, would you go center back or a nine?
I think I would go with a number nine. I think we talked about it on the last show. Caleb Porter came out and he said he thinks that Giacomo Vrioni can be the guy. If that's the case, then that'll be really, really good work for a Revs team that we talked about. Like their title window is open now, Weeby, given Carlos Hill, how good he still is, given the two wingers that they have on this team, and given the depth and veteran know-how that they have in defensive midfield. I expect them to be a much better defensive team than they were last year because I just expect it to be more coherent from the start of the season.
If I wanted to sell Giacomo Vrioni, I would come out and say Giacomo Vrioni, guy, is going to have a great season.
Fair.
Just saying. I never take what coaches or GMs say publicly as gospel. How about NYCFC?
Yeah, it's a good one. I mentioned Bakrar earlier this show. Right. Yeah, right. I like Bakrar. I think he can be a solid MLS forward. He didn't look like a guy who's going to score 15-20 goals. If they had a guy who scored 15-20 goals, I think we would look at this NYCFC team who had really bad luck with injuries last year and did not put their roster together until like late August. I think we would look at them as one of the favorites in the league. But I don't think they're going to go out and get a number nine like that. It's just not how they operate these days.
San Jose. Mitchell Bloom, Seth hit us up, said, Quakes, Lucci year two, finally selling K-Cal. Can they get a high-level 10 to take them to a team that is securely in the playoffs? If they get that 10, yes. Could they get a 10 that could take them to true contender status, Doyle?
It seems unlikely, doesn't it?
Hard to believe.
Yeah.
I don't think... To me, the issue with San Jose is there's not another Christian Espinoza-esque signing floating around for them in all likelihood.
Yeah.
Like, given the profile, the price tag that they're generally playing around with, to ask them to go hit another best 11 attacking creative player signing, not just out of the park, but across the street, that seems unlikely and like a challenge, but I'd love to see it.
And the other thing about that is if they went out and they spent that kind of money on that type of player, they would be recruiting over the two brightest lights in their academy, from their academy, which are Nico Sakiris and Cruz Medina. Cruz Medina played as the number 10 for the U.S. U-17 national team just this past autumn. They won two games. I forgot who they beat, but the two games they lost were to France and Germany, who made the final. They're still France and freaking Germany. And the U.S. played really well across that entire tournament. Cruz Medina is a big part of that. And he had otherwise, 2023 was a struggle for him, but he had at times been projected as a future star. They still think that he can be a future star. Nico Sakiris, maybe more of an 8.5, but a brilliant passer of the ball, like progressive passes all day. In this current roster, in this current lineup, we have seen him play as kind of a dual number 8 with Jackson Ewell. If they go out and they spend money on an elite number 10, they're pushing those guys further down the depth chart when I think the goal for San Jose is to be kind of the West Coast version of the Union, the team that pushes these guys into like a year early rather than a year late, push them into big minutes. So it'll be interesting. I don't it's a thought experiment with San Jose. I don't expect them to go out and make a signing like that.
Welcome to the ultimate thought experiment, which is MLS podcasting in the month of January. Hope you enjoyed this show, everybody. We sold you a bunch of fool's gold. I'm still in semi-regret over the Galaxy take, but I think at the end I sort of tied it all back together and covered my bases. So we'll see how I reflect on that in about 10 months or so. Enjoy the weekend. As always, follow Tom Bogert, all the news at MLSsoccer.com as well. We will see you next week. Enjoy your weekend, everybody. Adios.